Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And like always, I have another great guest. We have many, many guests. Tonight is my pleasure to have Anne Maria Hemingway on. And I think our topic is going to be pretty good tonight. So, hi, Anne Maria. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Nancy. Nice to be here.
Great. Anne Maria, could you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, please?
Well, a little bit about myself. I guess I'm going to probably just say, talk about the work I'm doing at the moment, which is related to practicing conscious living and dying. I'm the author of a book by the same name, and I'm actually completing my PhD dissertation on the near-death experience as a mythic model for conscious living and dying.
That's pretty great. Now, Anne Maria, have you had near-death experiences?
I haven't had a near-death experience myself. Throughout my research for the book and in courses I've been doing, I have met and researched a number of cases. I have had other similar incidents myself that, you know, would be termed as something sort of out of the ordinary state of everyday consciousness.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about them?
Well, I've had a few out-of-body experiences, which is a kind of similar state to the NDE, whereby you actually feel yourself leaving your physical body, mm-hmm. Often sort of able to see what's going on around you. I've also had after-death communications from my mother that have been very striking. And I think people who have had a similar incident will kind of know how much it differs from like an ordinary dream. You actually feel that you're asleep but awake, and in this state you actually come into contact with a loved one. So those are my sort of experiences.
When you had some of these experiences, did any of them kind of frighten you or make you think maybe you're, you know, just imagining things?
They didn't frighten me because I think that we're all able to have these experiences, whether it's a near-death experience, whether it's an after-death communication, or, you know, whether it's psychic phenomena that we experience. I think the thing is we just have to be open and ready to actually experience something like that. And for me, certainly with my mother, I found the experience to be really comforting and so real that it sort of really validated not only the work I was doing, but it gave me a feeling that there was, you know, something so much more following physical death. And I was so pleased to see her. So, no, I wasn't afraid.
That's really good. Sometimes people, when they experience, you know, some, we'll call them phenomenons for better lack of a better term, they do have a tendency to wonder if maybe they're just imagining it or if it could really be real. When somebody is having those kind of questions, Anne Maria, is there something that you can maybe tell them to maybe have them check or something they can do to reassure themselves that, yes, that really is what they're having?
Well, I think that it's really important to, you know, really validate your own experiences. From my experience, whenever I've asked anybody, agnostic, atheist, non-believer in certain things, whether they've actually had an experience in their life that was not explainable to them through rational means, I haven't come across a person yet who has said, no, they haven't. So I think this points to the fact that we are all experiencing things, you know, throughout our lifetimes to a certain degree or another. And that, you know, imagination is actually a wonderful place to be in because I think it was Plato who actually said, how can we tell, you know, whether we're in an imaginative state now or whether this dreaming imaginative state is real, and the opposite about the state we're in now. So I feel that people are always wanting to explain and rationalize their experiences, and that's when it becomes kind of disturbing or frightening at times, because sometimes there is no validation except for the person senses that they have experienced something that really stands out in their mind as being real.
Mm-hmm. With some of the people that you have interviewed for the stories that you wrote for Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, is there any one particular thing that most people have in common if they have like a near-death experience or, you know, any kind of, say, a communication from somebody who's already died?
Yes, I think for the NDE survivors, it's very clear that what happens is, in a sense, they die to an old way of viewing the world and an old way to living their lives. Most of them return realizing that they have some mission, a unique mission to accomplish, and this is the reason why they're coming back, and their whole world view is altered. I also found the same thing with people who have the courage to actually actively engage with a dying person, that they too not only learn what it is to be most authentically human when everything is stripped away, but what's really real. Mm-hmm. But also, in the stories of after death communication, it's that similar sort of feeling where this, you know, this idea of there being something more radically changes perception of life in some ways. That's what the book is about. It's not actually, you know, a morbid book. I think it's a very uplifting book. And the message is, it's sort of dying to an old state of being, an old state of viewing the world, and being reborn, if you like, with a different attitude. And certainly near-death experiences, you know, come back, even if they've had a negative NDE.
Mm-hmm.
They come back and they are radically changed. And it's very apparent in the way they choose to live their lives from that moment on that something extraordinary and very profound has happened to them.
You're also a member of the International Association for the Near-Death Studies.
Mm-hmm.
So for part of your book, did you interview some of the other members of the association?
Well, three of the stories actually in the book are people who are members of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. They are near-death experiencers who are members of the society themselves. And, you know, Irons really does a lot of work in this respect, because when you spoke earlier about people being afraid, were they losing their mind, was there something, you know, really strange going on with them, I think this was how a lot of near-death experiencers felt. And they had nowhere sometimes, if they started to tell their family or friends what had happened, you know, people either don't want to listen or they're afraid of what the person is telling them, or they don't believe them. So IONS provides not only a very informative platform for anybody who wants to know more, and actually, you know, shows research that's going on in scientific and medical world, but it also provides people who have had a near-death experience and may be feeling those alienated feelings a place where they can talk and meet with other people who have experienced a similar thing, and can assure them that they're not suffering from, you know, some major breakdown or being weird.
Mm-hmm. When people talk about near-death experiences, a lot of people talk about seeing the white light.
They do.
In the course of your study and writing your book, did you see that like when you talked with them, did most of them talk about seeing the white light?
I think all of them talk about seeing the white light. The white light is a pivotal element of the NDE, and it is so overpowering that the light is one of the central things that, however much people want to describe this, it's so difficult to describe, because obviously you're coming back into normal everyday consciousness and you're trying to describe something that is out of that state of consciousness, and it's very difficult to even find the words to explain it. So the light is an overwhelming sensation of being in this brilliance. And most people often say that the light appears to be, you know, far brighter than the sun, and yet they can look into it and they have no problem. It's they're surrounded by this light, and they often feel that they actually are part of this light at that time.
A lot of people that I have talked with who have had near-death experiences have told me that it's almost when they see that light, they have a really hard time deciding if they want to continue walking toward the light or actually coming back. In years, you know, like when you were writing your stories and talking with people, did a lot of that come out too?
Yes, I think in most cases, people either had a moment where perhaps, you know, they were almost afraid of being drawn into this light, but did go forward.
Mm-hmm.
Other people say the opposite, you know, that they're drawn into the light and then they don't want to return, even though they may be told, you know, this isn't your time or you must go back. The feeling of dismay at having to do this is often something that near-death experiences, when they do return, you know, find very hard to integrate. You know, they may go into a depression for a while and wish they hadn't had to come back. One thing for certain, after being in this incredible luminous light, and returning from whatever else, you know, they experienced during their NDE. And although for people, they have their own unique experience, most of them seem to follow a sort of set pattern in a way, of what they do experience. Returning is, you know, is very difficult for them.
If somebody wanted to get in touch with you, Anna Marie, is that possible?
Yes, they can go onto my website, which is www.practicingconsciouslivinganddying.com, and they can get contact information from there. There is a page that actually gives contact information. Or I don't know how easy it is for people actually to write down email addresses, but my actual email address is annamariahemingway@gmail.com. So I'm very open to anybody who, you know, who may like to communicate, ask a question, have more details of the book, certainly.
Can I ask you what prompted you to write a book about the conscious living and dying?
Well, my own mother's death was such a profound experience for me that I felt there was more in it than just being with her through her dying process, which, as I say, was a very profound experience and one that I write about in the book. But what came out of her death, and I think what was the gift of her life, actually, was the fact that I did write this book. I was told by a psychic shortly after my mother's death that I would write a book of modern-day parables that would help people come to terms with the dying process and appreciate life. And at the time, I was working on a book of poetry, and I was saying to him, but I want to finish my poetry book. And he said to me, no, you can always do that as a sideline, but this is the book you're going to write. And actually, I did. So I feel that it was my mother's death and the process I went through with her gave birth to this book. And the book is dedicated to my mother. And I believe that part of the reason that we had such a profound experience together was exactly for that purpose, to write this book.
How long did it take you to write your book?
I suppose the actual writing, putting together of it, took a year. But the actual research, interviewing people, transcribing tapes, and then actually, you know, writing a story, I wanted it to be real life stories, and I wanted people to speak in their own voice, but obviously, you know, you actually have to write a story. So that all took quite a long time, quite a lengthy process. So I would say probably in total about 3 years.
At any time did you kind of think, why am I doing this?
I did. I think anybody that's writing anything, you know, goes through stages of, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm never going to finish this. You know, I want to do other things. But once I had got all the material together, I actually felt almost compelled to write it. I feel that although I wrote it, I was guided, if you like, into writing it. I think it's a very important book. It's powerful. It may help people in the grieving process, people that are trying to understand, you know, the mystery of life, why we're here, why we suffer, you know, what may possibly happen when we die. And so I believe it was a mission that I was given. And so consequently, even though sometimes it became very frustrating, I never actually wanted to give up with the idea.
Do you think people need to practice conscious living in order to allow the dying process to happen?
I think they do. I think the problem is, you know, with modern day life that we look to everything to extend life. Dying, the dying, bereavement, grief. We don't want to deal with anymore. We have become very disconnected from the rhythms of nature, from the natural world, from the consciousness that perhaps people a long time ago had. And so now we find it incredibly difficult to deal with the whole subject. And we look to, I don't know, plastic surgery, working out in the gym, whatever we can to stave off the day when ultimately, you know, there is no escapability from the fact that, you know, death is part of the circle of life. We are born into the world and we will transition from this world. And in order to make our life worthwhile and savor every moment of its preciousness, we have to be aligned with this fact, what it means to actually be alive, to be fully conscious of our own mortality. In a way, gives us a gift. It makes life more precious. And the disconnection doesn't help us when we suddenly find somebody close to us is dying or has died. We can't accept it as a normal part of the cycle of life. And so, you know, grieving itself is not even experienced as something that needs to be gone through. Often people, you know, pull yourself together, you know, life goes on. People don't want to discuss somebody that's died. I met a woman the other day who'd been married for 50 years and her husband had passed away, and she said to me, you know, one of the saddest things for me is that I go out and I see friends that we used to do things with together and they never mention my husband. And it would be so nice for me. I want to talk about him. I want to remember those times. But there's always this sort of barrier. So I think that it, you know, in order for there not to be, I think we need to embrace what it actually means to live consciously and well. And part of that, again, is the idea of actually dying to old ways of viewing the world.
And I find, you know, the way you're looking at it and explaining it very interesting, because a lot of people, I have to agree with you, Anne-Marie, is that they don't want to talk about somebody who has died or somebody who is in the process of dying. They want to try to overlook that. And at some point in time, everybody has to do that.
Yes, everybody has to do it. And I think from my experience and other people that, you know, are prepared to accept that, I think that we don't realize that, you know, that way of thinking actually deprives us of really transformational experiences and, you know, perhaps actually ourselves are being altered. I firmly believe that a dying person is in an altered state of consciousness, and in that state, you know, they are very much more aware of what's going on, even though they may not appear to be so on the surface, and that we can really learn a lot in that place. And there are, you know, deathbed visions, which are extraordinary events, which are very well documented, where somebody comes to actually collect the dying person. It may be a religious figure, a deceased family member. Again, this is something that most people could ridicule and say, oh, you know, they're hallucinating, it's drugs, this, that, and the other. But actually, it happens a lot, and hospice workers are often able to view this phenomena too. So, you know, actually being fully present and being there can open us up to all sorts of extraordinary other things happening, more than just the physical decay of the body.
Mm-hmm. When I was a nurse, I used to work in a geriatric hospital. And so I got to see, you know, many older people who were in the process of transitioning, and some of them would really fight it, and some of them would really actually welcome it. But one thing that a lot of them had in common was that they would always be reaching out, like they were trying to touch something or somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yes, I think that's very common. I did have a friend who was dying from AIDS several years ago, and he was very afraid of his own death. As he got nearer to that place, one day his whole demeanor, his whole mood had changed, become much more relaxed, and he was smiling and talking to all these people and having a whole conversation and whatever. He died shortly afterwards, and he had actually stopped fighting it, and it was an incredible, you know, it was an incredible sight to actually see whatever it was that was going on with him right at that moment. You know, was really amazing and certainly changed his outlook. And I think a lot of near-death experiences that I have met are often interested in either working in hospice or working with the dying. And they seem to be able to help a dying person actually come into the place that you were just speaking about. And having worked in hospice myself for a while, I certainly, you know, understand how people think, oh, hospice is the place you're going to go and you're just going to die, and it's terrible and it's morbid and upsetting. And, you know, again, it's, the atmosphere is not like that at all, and well, not in my experience. Obviously, there you know, the dying process is different for each individual, but the actual atmosphere is, you know, one of tranquility and peace, and something often very beautiful is taking place.
Do you think if people kind of believed and knew that they were really going to a better place, that a lot of things would be changing for their soul, that they may not try to fight the dying process or be so afraid of it?
I think that's exactly how it would be. But I also believe that not only would it mean that perhaps people are not so afraid of the actual idea of dying themselves, I think removing that anxiety would actually change the way they're living their lives, and things that seem to be terribly important may not be so important. Other things may, you know, may become more important, and living life may become different, because for a lot of people, I think life is a battle for survival. And I'm sure that everybody, you know, if they think about it, probably accepts that they have a conscious, or maybe for a lot of people a subconscious, fear around that subject, and live with it all their lives, and it affects the way they live their lives.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, after talking with a lot of people who have had a near-death experience, that they kind of know when their time really is going to be going, and when it's going to be happening? Do you think their soul may know that ahead of time?
It's quite possible. In my experience, most people have said to me that they know they're here for a purpose. One of the stories in the book is about a man who had a massive heart attack, and he had a near-death experience, and when he returned, he was told that he was going to return, that he had something to accomplish, and he didn't know what that was, but he was told certainly by the surgeons that he had to have open heart surgery or else he would be dead in 3 months. And he had this overwhelming feeling that he should not have the surgery, because he had something to do and he needed to get on with it. And he refused the surgery. He didn't take any of the medication prescribed. And he discovered that his mission was actually to work as a spiritual counselor to the dying. And this man, for the last, I don't know how many years, I certainly have known him for 8, works round the clock, sometimes 16, 18 hours a day, may have as many as 50 dying people and families that he's looking after at one time. And although he's aware that, you know, he has this heart condition, he is living a life that people half his age would not even be able to keep up with. And he said to me several times, I know that I will be here until I have done all the work that I am meant to be doing. And I think a lot of them tend to look at it like that, you know, that whether they have a sense of when that's going to be, I don't know. But I know that they all seem to have a very strong sense that I'll be here until I've completed the work that I'm meant to be doing. And this man, Ruben, whose story is in the book, has told me that once or twice he's felt kind of burned out and slowed down, and then he's felt ill again. Got back, you know, with his patients and clients, and has recovered. So in his mind, it certainly seems that, you know, what he was told to do is exactly what he's doing, and while he's doing it, he will be alive and well. And, you know, when the time has come that he's no longer needed, or he's done everything that he was supposed to do, that he will transition from this, you know, earthly existence. But I don't think that many of them seem to worry about it, to be quite honest, because they have no fear of dying, so they don't look upon it in the same way as everybody else does.
When you were interviewing some people, did you meet anybody who had more than one near-death experience?
Well, the man I just spoke about actually had had a near-death experience at 13 as well, so he had had two. He wasn't quite sure after the first one, at a young age, exactly what it is he was meant to do with the experience. And it wasn't quite as strong as the second one. I've come across quite a few people who have had more than one. You know, why this should be that they in their lives have encountered something, you know, so traumatic, car crash, surgery or whatever, I don't know, and they don't really know the answer to that, but it certainly seems that perhaps either the veil between the two worlds is lifted slightly. When I say that, I believe that we could all have near-death experiences in a sense, because I think the near-death experience is really penetrating the veil between consciousness. I'm not saying that we all, you know, need to have some major illness or terrible car accident or something to have a near-death experience and come back. But what I'm saying is the place that they go to is somewhere that we could all access. It's another state of consciousness. They access it in that way, maybe once or twice or more times. But it's no different from the place that we can access through other means. It's just, you know, stepping through that door.
When some people have had more than one near-death experience, has it changed kind of their outlook a second time?
Yes, and some people believe that perhaps, you know, they needed to go again. Reuben did have that view. He had a near-death experience at 13. He was trying to kill himself because he felt abused and neglected, and he came back and he'd experienced this amazing feeling of love and well-being that he'd never had before. And then he said 40 years passed, you know, he established a career in banking and made money and had a couple of divorces and, you know, led a pretty kind of normal life for most people. And then had another near-death experience. Of course, his whole life has completely, dramatically changed since then. But I think he sort of says, you know, I wasn't quite sure what I was meant to do with the experience. And that he knew he'd had it, that he'd experienced these things, and he'd never felt that kind of love or acceptance or well-being again. But it didn't have that particular time, although one of the things he did say was it stopped him ever thinking of the idea of suicide again. And I think that's a very important point, that there are people who have had an NDE when trying to, you know, end their own lives, and they've certainly come back and really, like he has said, would never think of doing that again. But you know, maybe they just need another push in a certain direction.
Sometimes people are pretty hard-headed.
Well, I think that's true, actually. I mean, when a person has an NDE, a lot of them do say it really is this place of dying to your old values and dying to your old self. One lady described it as coming back to have to make a better movie. And I think, you know, that some people may find that a difficult thing to do. You know, they have another near-death experience to remind them.
It's like, wake up.
Yes.
When I was 6 years old, I actually had a very freaky accident where I actually should have died or been paralyzed, and I'm neither one. I landed with my head under my back.
Oh my goodness.
I was kind of like headless, and my brothers, I'm sure, thought I had died, so they did not touch me. I do not remember seeing a white light. But what I do remember is this angelic voice talking to me the entire time, telling me that I'm okay, there's nothing wrong with you, you know a lot of things now, Nancy, you can't use it yet, we'll let you know when. So the entire time I lay like that, that's what I kept hearing. And even as I actually started to regain consciousness and, you know, start to know that I'm still alive here, that there's still something on, I was not in any pain whatsoever. I wasn't afraid, you know, of what was going on, maybe because I was so young or maybe because I was so beautiful, but I was not afraid. And it was very, very different because once I came to, I was laying on my back, but I was looking at the ground, and I still wasn't afraid. And I don't know if it was considered near death. I'm not sure. I just know this experience that I had.
Yes, well, it sounds certainly as though something very powerful and dramatic happened to you. When you were talking a while ago about, you know, whether people have more than one and, you know, how old they are, and as you were saying, you were a child when this happened. I think in a sense, we have to also remember that, you know, we base our lives and our perceptions on linear time. And that actually, in a near-death experience, we also, you know, lose the constraint of that linear time as well. People will often say the experience could have lasted a couple of minutes or, you know, 4 or 5 hours. Time as we view it in our normal waking state seems to have absolutely, you know, no relevance. So, although you were a child, you know, in the continuum, that sort of doesn't really, you know, doesn't really matter, because I think, you know, we view everything when we were young, when we were middle-aged, when we were old, you know, whatever happened from 1 year to the next. But you clearly sort of stepped into a, you know, another form of consciousness. You had an experience that was out of everyday consciousness and time.
And what happened after that is I could look at people and I would know that they were going to die.
Oh.
But my angels, as I call them, would not let me tell anybody. They would not let me let people know what I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't do that until I was much, much older. But that's how I grew up, knowing, you know, that I could see these things and I knew them.
Mm.
And again, I wasn't afraid of any of them. And all I wanted to do was to tell the person that they're going to be going to a better place. But I still wasn't allowed to do it.
No. Well, you just mentioned, you know, a point that's also very interesting, which is, you know, many people who've had a near-death experience or some altered, you know, form of consciousness, that they return, you know, with enhanced abilities. Some of them have psychic, healing, telepathic abilities. And, you know, again, we look at that, you know, as being sort of something very special or something that, you know, can only happen to a few people. But I think we all have this ability. It's just that these experiences, you know, as you described just now, something seems to happen that revs up the process. And, you know, we become aware. And it's interesting, you know, when we look back in time, even to Jung's day, he actually spoke a lot about death and dying. And he, you know, he would say that when he was a young boy, people had sort of similar awareness to the one that you were just speaking about yourself, you know, that they would know when something was going to happen, or a clock would stop when somebody died, or a glass would shatter or something. And that he spoke of when he was a young child, that was just part of life, and how we had actually lost that ability to be that connected to what was going on. And, you know, probably animals have more of a sense of that kind of intuition now than we do ourselves.
I think that's quite true. There may be a caller. Let me just check. Is there a caller on the line? Okay. If there's anyone out there who's listened who may have a question to ask Anne Maria about an experience or just a question in general, please feel free to call in. The number is on the screen. In the meantime, Anne Marie, like, and so what happened to me is, you know, throughout this process, you know, my psychic ability developed very, very well, very, very quickly. And I, you know, that's what I do today. Mm-hmm. I do my psychic readings, and they're usually pretty good. And there are times still when I can look at somebody and I know that they're going to die. And yet, it's not for me to tell that person that, because again, I keep being reminded that this is not my concern, that they're going to a better place, that they've chosen this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, my next question is, in the times that you were interviewing people, did anybody tell you that they kind of knew that this was going to be going on and for whatever reason, they're actually quite comfortable with the whole, you know, the whole process?
Are you talking about the process of knowing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the stories I have in my book is about a lady called Tiffany Snow who had a near-death experience after being electrocuted. And after she came back, she, you know, found that her own healing abilities were enhanced, which is what she does now. And I said to her, well, what happens if you have a sense that the person isn't going to get better? And she said, well, you know, I always have heat in my hands when I'm working with people, and sometimes if they're not going to be better, I don't get that. And I know that they have, exactly what you just said, they have chosen to leave and move on. And she was saying that if somebody was, you know, very open to that idea themselves, that perhaps, you know, one might discuss it. But no, she wouldn't tell them, and, you know, unless that's something they wanted to hear. But if it was apparent that the person was not going to recover, she would probably just tell them, not, you know, not specifically saying to them, you're not going to be healed or get better, but she would just tell them of her experience and the place she went to and how wonderful it was, and for them to understand that her experience made her not afraid and convinced that, you know, that a better place awaited. Mm-hmm. So I think that people may just, you know, tell their stories of their near-death experiences without homing in on a particular person, but just in general, so that people can understand, you know, whatever it is, at some point in your life you will be leaving here, and it's not something to be afraid of.
And I agree, but I think people look at it as, again, with that fear of that unknown. And when people have enough courage to talk about their experiences and what they felt or what, you know, what has happened, a lot of people then realize that they have had a near-death experience but didn't really know what it was.
Yes, I think that's certainly true. And I think that goes back to the place where, you know, they've had an experience and perhaps there's been nobody to discuss it with, or maybe people that are listening now actually might think, oh, wow, well, I must have had a near-death experience. You know, I left my body or went into the light or was, you know, met by a being of light or was given information or was told to come back to my body. And I didn't realize until now, you know, that that had happened.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times also when I was, you know, in doing nursing, people who were deciding if they wanted to stay or to go, they would be unconscious. And one of the things that I made sure that I wanted people to understand is just because they're unconscious doesn't mean they can't hear what you're saying. And that they would have to be very careful of that, because people who chose not to go at the time and did come back told stories about what they had heard was going on in the room, or they described people that had been there to see them in perfect detail.
Yes, and I think that's, you know, one of the things that is really giving credence to the near-death experience, or other out-of-body experiences is when somebody can describe a whole scene. Going back to the book, and in one of the near-death experiences I write about, as a man was being taken to hospital, he could feel himself in his brother's house in Oregon, which was miles away from his California home, and he was in the house with his brother and sister-in-law, and his brother was going on a fishing trip, and you know, he said, it was all very mundane. His brother was going on a fishing trip, and his wife didn't like the sound of that. And as he was talking, she was just thinking about what she was going to do when he was gone. And, you know, then he found himself back in the ambulance. And later he said to his brother, you know, I had this conversation, and there you were talking to your wife of this fishing trip, of all things, and it was exactly how he described, word for word. So this idea, you know, that consciousness is moving in and out of all these different areas, and as you say, just because a person is unconscious to us, that would mean that they can't hear or see anything. That's not true at all. When my mother, just before she died, I was with her, and it so happened that my brother had gone out to his office to make an important call, and my son had left to do something, and I was with my mother, and for all intents and purposes, she was unconscious. She had been for the 2 or 3 days that we'd been sitting with her, and I just said to her, you know, I knew that moment was incredibly important. And I felt that it was just me that was meant to be there. And I said to her, you know, you've been a wonderful mother and grandmother, you know, and we're all going to miss you terribly. But, you know, it's okay now. You can leave, you know. And she took a final breath within a minute. And by the time they came back, all this happened within 3 or 4 minutes. She had gone. And I think, in a sense, she almost wanted us or somebody to say, you know, it's okay for you to leave. And often a dying person is needing that from the relative or whoever's with them to say, it's okay for you to leave now, you know?
Mm-hmm. See, and again, I agree with what you're saying, because when people have come to me for their readings and they've asked me about, you know, a relative or somebody who's been very sick and is, you know, kind of not knowing if they want to stay or go. And I tell the person kind of what you just said, you know, that you told your mom. I tell them subconsciously or without saying it out loud, if it's too hard, you can tell that person that it's okay to go if they're tired, if they really want to join their other loved ones, if, you know, if they really are ready, it's okay that everybody here will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, if they want to go, that's great. And a lot of times, just like you said, it happens very quickly after that.
Yes. And I think, you know, that's a very important thing to remember, that we, you know, we are often very emotionally attached, of course, to our loved ones, and the grief is overwhelming. And there isn't any cure for that. It has its own timetable, and individuals feel that, because even though we may have a sense of them going on to somewhere better, them still being with us, we're not going to have their physical presence. And, you know, that's a very hard thing when you love somebody, to not be able to have them in your physical life anymore. But at the same time, we need to let them go, because often they're just staying here for us, and, you know, they're struggling or very sick, and they need that permission for us to kind of, you know, go beyond that place of grief to say, you know, it's okay for you to leave. Of course we'll miss you terribly, but you must go.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, often it happens, you know, very quickly then.
And then I've had people call back and say, well, I did what you said, Nancy, and my mom or my dad, they died like almost instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And and then they want to talk because then they feel guilty because they said it was okay. And so it's like you have to reassure that person that said it was okay that they really are going to a much, much better place.
Well, and also I think we have to remember that it is a natural part of the life cycle again, you know, that it isn't something that is for anyone to feel guilty about or bad about. I mean, the things that we do feel guilty about sometimes is that, you know, a person has died and we realize that the last conversation we had with them wasn't a very good one, or we hadn't spoken to them for 5 years. I mean, these are the things when we talk about conscious living, these are the things to be aware of, you know, that sometimes death brings up those terrible places, estrangements, you know, places that we feel really badly about because we forget that earthly existence is limited. And I think that's another very valuable thing to remember, you know, to try and live in that way, that we are actually in a place where the last conversation we had with anyone would be okay, you know, even if it's an argument or whatever, that we're conscious all the time of the way we are with the people we care about and people in general. You know, the place that near-death experiences certainly really get is that place of interconnection, that we are all connected and that, you know, we're all living this life.
Mm-hmm. And Maria, could you tell the listeners again how to get in touch with you and also where to get your book?
Yes, they can get in touch with me through my website, which is www.practicingconsciouslivinganddying.com, all one. If that sounds a bit of a mouthful, they can just do www.annamariahemingway.com, and Hemingway just has one M. For some reason, lots of people seem to stick in too. The book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, comes out on the 25th of January. It's available now, though, from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any good bookshop, and if people want to contact me directly by email, they can do so on annamariahemingway@gmail.com. But as I said, if that all sounds a mouthful, if anybody just does a Google and types in Anna Maria Hemingway, all that information will be available to them.
That's good to know, because some people go, holy cow.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem with having a long name.
Yeah. And then when they want to add another letter into it, it makes it even harder.
Yes, it does.
Anna Maria, I do have another question. You talk about your mother's dying. In her process of dying, at any time, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, were you hoping that it was maybe just a wrong, you know, diagnosis or just a wrong thing going on and she would come out of it at any time?
No, unfortunately for my mother, her illness went on for about 15 years and she went through a tremendous amount of surgery and treatments. Looking back, I think we all feel that we wish we had not allowed her to go on. But I think, you know, people do when they, if they want to try different things, that they must do that. I knew in the last year or so that as a family, we came to realize that there would be no turning back. We were on the downward path, if you like, as far as the physical health was going. So I think once we'd come to that conclusion as a family and knew that, then everybody had to make a choice of how they were going to deal with it. And one of the things about having somebody, you know, dying that is close to you, as I said before, it strips everything away bar what is essential. And I decided I wanted to be with my mother every step of the way. And I think that it was that that actually helped me come to terms with what was happening. And it, you know, was a devastating loss. I was close to my mother. I missed her. I still miss her every day. And I'm sure, you know, it's the same with everybody when we've lost somebody. And although my mother wasn't the only person I lost in my life, I think a mother is such a, you know, a central, pivotal figure in our lives that it's a very hard thing to deal with. So, that is the answer, you know, to the question, really. I think once you take on board that, you know, this is what's going to happen, you then have a choice of how you're going to deal with it. And as I say in the book there, you know, were moments of really deep grief and despair and upset and questions and why and, you know, how could she go through so much and everything. And there were also the most beautiful moments that I would never have experienced in my life. I mean, in a sense, I'm sad that it was part of that process, but at the same time, I realized that the dying process is full, you know, of both of those things. Incredible insight, clarity. You can connect with a person the way you never have done in your entire life. I never realized how much my mother loved me and how much I loved her until those few months. So, you know, I would advise anyone, hard as it may be, that if that is the situation, you know, embrace it and be with it. And, you know, that there will be no regrets, nothing left unsaid. But everything, in a sense, is accomplished in this cycle of that person's life.
That's great. Our time, Anna Maria, is really over, but I would like you one more time to please give out information where they could get a hold of you or your book.
Okay, the book, Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, is published by O Books. It will be out on the 25th of January. It's available through any good bookstore, Amazon.com. If anybody wants to get in touch with me directly, they can do so at AnnaMariaHemingway@gmail.com. And there is a website on the book which gives reviews, endorsements, a full description, which is www.practicingconsciousliving.com. So if anybody wants to get in touch with me, though, personally, do so on the email, and I'll be happy to answer any questions or give out any further information.
Great. Thank you very much, Anna Maria, for being my guest. It has been my pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Nancy, for having me. It's been great talking to you, and thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Great. Everybody go out, get the book, learn what you need to learn. You take care.
Yes, you too.
May God bless all of you that are listening. Have a great week, and take care. We'll talk to you next week. Bye now.